Mr. Watson, reel 5. Did you get out into the country on shooting parties and things like this?
Oh, yes, rather. In those days, during the winter months, during the winter holidays, one used to take what was known as a shooting block, where you had a large area which was allotted to you, and there was a bungalow attached, and you could stay there. And from there you went out and you're doing your shooting, whatever you were after, usually deer, small game. I never went in after anything big. Personally, I didn't feel capable anyway, but and also the tiger were getting rather shot out. One interesting story, some friends of mine, they were two were Anglo, the man and his wife were Anglo-Indian, and the other two were British. We went out on a shoot, and we separated, and we all had guns which were loaded with shot rather than anything else. We weren't after anything bigger than a deer, anyway. And we were in different parts, sort of separated about 100 yards from each other, when suddenly there was an... I was right at the back. One of them, the Anglo-Indian, a fellow called Melville, heard a most terrific roar quite near to him. We all heard it, of course, but it was obviously near to him, and he knew that there was a tiger in the vicinity, so he stood absolutely still. And then came this roar again and this rumbling, and he didn't know what to do, because quite apart from anything else, he didn't quite know exactly where the tiger was. And he hadn't suitable ammunition anyway. Then suddenly, without a warning, the other man, the Britisher over the other side, getting very worried, thought he'd fire a shot into the air, which he did. And that, in the hope that that would scare the tiger off. And actually it did just the opposite. It went straight for this Melville, straight for Melville. And as it came to him, it went straight at him, and then just before it got to him, about a yard away, it swerved off and went off into the jungle. Well, of course, he was absolutely terrified. We all heard it going off, and he stood there for about 3 minutes, absolutely shaking, and he was wet through with sweat, with perspiration, and as white as a sheet, and he came very slowly back. And we all gathered together, and then, of course, we realized that what had happened was that it was a tigress having had cubs, and it was very worried about the cubs. But it was an awe-inspiring incident indeed.
Did you have any other trouble with dangerous animals in India, like snakes?
Yes. We had, in fact, I had several quite, well, they turned out to be amusing incidents. I remember once coming out of my office in October, when the snakes are getting rather dormant, tending to hibernate, and this was dark, and I stepped on, or getting dark anyway, and I stepped on a Russell's viper. The viper shot up the drain pipe, and I was absolutely convinced I had been bitten. I could feel the bite all the time, and of course I hadn't. I was very fortunate, and I know it was a Russell viper, and if it had been, of course it would have been very unpleasant indeed. At other times, I remember once one of the chowkidars, that's the servant who looks after the college grounds, came down and said, "Saab, there's a sump, as they called it, there's a snake up in the tree." will you come and get it down? Will you come and shoot it down? So I had the job of getting one of the rifles from the armory and putting it into the snake. Apart from that, the most unpleasant thing that would happen would be a snake coming into the bungalow, and that happened twice in my case. Once I came down from early morning period, 8:30, and found one on the in the hall. We managed to kill that all right, and the second time there was one in my son's bedroom. well, he was only about 12, I suppose. But
whilst he was in the bedroom?
No, he wasn't in the bedroom, fortunately. And no, he'd been out, I can't remember, he'd probably been out for a walk. Well, he couldn't have been 12, he must have been younger than that. He must have been with the IRS, I think, I don't know. Anyway, he used to pride himself on his shooting, so I got the CSM to bring a couple of rifles down from the armory and told him to stand behind, gave one to my son and said, well, there you are, see what you can do. And we opened the door, and there was this. There were both cobras, the one in the hall prior to this, and the one in his bedroom was a cobra. And of course, up it came the moment the door was opened, started waving its head around. And with the CSM behind, my son had a crack at it and fortunately got it. But that was the sort of thing that happened. You always had to be very, very careful in the summer. There was always a liability of snakes around. There was a very big nullah behind. That is a kind of dry stream ditch. And they would very often come up from there. So that, as I say, you had to be extremely careful. And you also had to watch out for scorpions, too. Scorpions in your slipper, for instance.
Did you get bitten?
I never got bitten, no. I remember a Mali, I was staying in Allahabad once, and a Mali got bitten there, and this was in the early morning, and he came to the Memsahib, and he said, this was the Memsahib of the friends I was staying with, and he said, Memsahib, I've been bitten by a scorpion. So she said, well, you better go and rest. Here's medicine. She gave him some aspirin. There wasn't much she could do. Gave him some aspirin, told him to take them and go and rest and not come back till tomorrow. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he was back. They never worked in the afternoon. It was too hot, and they'd start again at 4 o'clock. He was back at 4 with his head all bandaged up. And, of course, the Mali said, the Memsahib said to him, what have you got your head bandaged for? And he said, oh, I went to the bazaar, to the medicine man in the bazaar, and he gave me something. He poured something in my ear, and that should cure the scorpion bite in my foot, which is most extraordinary and rather typical of the ignorance of the wretched poorer class out there.
Did you take any interest in Indian arts and customs, like the Taj Mahal and the sculpture and handicrafts and so on?
Up to a point, yes. Certainly the Taj Mahal, I mean, that was a sight that was never forgotten. That was never to be forgotten, that. Indian history rather than arts, yes. I was very interested in the Mughal period, particularly as I'd been on holiday in Delhi and in Agra, and from Delhi we'd made excursions to the forbidden, or the lost city rather, of Fatehpur Sikri, which was built by Akbar. He thought he'd have this city, which is about 23 miles from Agra, and it's all in red sandstone except for one marble tomb in the middle. But after 2 years he had to leave it because there was a shortage of water. But it's in a wonderful state of preservation. Apart from that, no. I don't think one got the opportunity.
What did you think to Indian arts and so on?
Well, I could never get on with the Indian music. That's the thing that just defeated me, I'm afraid. It seemed to be tuneless. I think that was ignorance on my part, and I think it always will be. I mean, I was brought up in a classical type of European music, and the other just didn't strike a chord at all.
Was this Indian folk music or Indian classical
music? Any form of Indian music, whether it was folk music or classical. I was too ignorant to know the difference anyway. From the art point of view, yes. I mean, from the sculpture point of view, I think some of the sculptures are really magnificent, and I regret that I haven't seen enough of them. Of course, the Taj and the two forts, the fort in Delhi and the fort in Agra, are outstanding. And I always appreciated the history attached to them, but of course that's a long story.
Did you enjoy India and regret leaving, or were you glad to get out?
I was very sorry I had to go. I enjoyed it right through. And if it hadn't been for Indianization, I won't say I'd have been there now because I'm retired, but I would have been right up to retirement age, very definitely. It's quite a different life. One got on extremely well, as I say, being segregated like that and being in contact with the army side of India rather than the political and the civilian side, one enjoyed it so very much more. And I regret it. I don't think I would like to go back now. I certainly wouldn't like to go back to live. I wouldn't mind going back for a visit, but I think the changes are not for the better in so many ways.
Can you tell me what other Europeans you and your wife met, apart from the Europeans who were working at the college? What type of Europeans were there?
Rather limited. In the sense that they could be classified under about four headings, I think. First of all, there was the academy, the military academy. Then there was the Forest Research Institute, which catered for the whole of India and Southeast Asia. They had their own British officers and families. When I say officers, they were civilians, of course. Then there were the Gurkha regiments, and apart from that, the bank manager, one or two Anglo-Indians, one or two Indians of that one met, and that's about all.
To what extent did the attitudes of these other sections of the European community in India differ? I mean, their attitudes towards India and Indians. To what extent did it differ to that of your own as teachers?
Now, are you thinking of the Anglo-Indian, do you mean, or the Indian itself, or the civilian Britisher, or what? I'm not quite sure.
I mean the attitudes of the other sections of the British community. How did their attitude towards India differ from your own?
I doubt whether they did, frankly. I mean, certainly from the military standpoint, they were absolutely wrapped up with their regiment to begin with. From the military academy point of view, there again, they were completely bound up with the running of the academy and the cadets themselves there, and of course they always got on extremely well with them. In the Forest Research Institute and the district commissioner, well, they of course had Indians under them who depended on them entirely, so that they must have enjoyed their life in India. In fact, I know they did. So that I think I can't see any difference in attitude at all between any of the people that we came in contact, anyway.
Do you think there was a difference in attitude between the British Army officer towards the Indians he worked with as compared with the Boxwaller, with the people he worked with?
Well, I wouldn't like to comment on that because I don't know enough about the Boxwaller's life, as it were. As I say, Dehradun was a place by itself, and you only found the Boxwallers in the larger towns and cities like Delhi, Calcutta, Madras, Lahore. And so we didn't come into contact with that side of their life. So it'd be rather difficult for me to comment on that at all.
Can we talk about the Anglo-Indians? How did the Britishers get on with the Anglo-Indians?
I think that is rather an unfortunate side of the whole issue. The Anglo-Indian was in between two stools. He didn't mix with the British, or the British didn't mix with the Anglo-Indian, nor did the Indian mix with the Anglo-Indian. And so he, as I say, was betwixt the devil and the deep sea, as it were. And I think that's an awful shame, because there are some very fine Anglo-Indians indeed. And they have done a very good job on the railways. They always have. An instance of the attitude which I gather of the Indian towards the Anglo-Indian is the slowness of promotion. The Anglo-Indian in the army finds it more difficult, I think. I've gathered this. To get his promotion when he's up against the Indian. I think it's all political, really.
You said that there wasn't mixing between the Anglo-Indian and the British community, but in your earlier story about the Tigris, you said you were out with
yes,
Anglo-Indian friends there.
That's quite true. Now, I should probably... modify that by saying that until partition, one found that the English people were not mixing with the Anglo-Indian. I knew several in Dehradun, and I found them very pleasant people, easy to get on with, and capable.
Did you go to each other's houses?
Yes, not very often, I must admit. But later on, I think there was an easing of the attitude towards them, very much so.
After partition?
After partition.
Did you think it was odd or natural to be in India as an Englishman?
No. Even at partition, I got the impression that India was not ready for it. Incidentally, I remember one of my cadets. He was a major at the time. He was up at the college visiting, and he said to me, "He said, sir, I'm going to be a lieutenant colonel. In no time at all, I'll be a colonel. I'm not ready for it." He said, "How am I expected to be able to cope?" It's a great pity that partition has been so soon. It means that all the high-ranking, or most of the high-ranking British officers will go, and our promotion will be more rapid. And I do not think that the time is ripe. And going back to earlier stages, one got the impression that it was the Britisher who was doing a tremendous lot for the Indian. helping him, educating him, not only academically, but also helping him to realize his ambitions, for instance, in the army and in the Indian civil service. And I think that I certainly felt that it was nothing out of the ordinary my being in India under those conditions.
And so, whilst you were in India, did you expect British rule to end at all?
Well, I knew it was coming in the last, well, I can't remember how long, perhaps the last year, 40, when I say year 46, 47, it was obviously coming then, because there'd been so much tendency towards that way prior to that. But it did come suddenly, there was no doubt about that, when Mountbatten came and handed it over.
Before the end of the war, did you think that British rule was ever going to end?
I personally hadn't sort of given it a great deal of thought, and it never struck me that, I assume naturally that it would come to an end ultimately, but it never seemed to strike me that it might be in my time, put it that way. It obviously would come to an end. I mean, we were educating the masses of India as well as the more educated type of Indian, and obviously he was ultimately going to take over. That stood to reason.
Did you think that British rule was a good thing for India?
I do. I do very much, yes. It obviously had its drawbacks, its bad moments, its bad points. I should think quite possibly a number of Britishers didn't treat their servants as well as they might have done. But on the other hand, I have been told by many an Indian since then, or many a servant since partition, that he was treated far better by the Britisher than by the Indian himself. The Indian did not look after his servants. So that from that point of view, and from the help that was given to the masses in India, I think that British rule was not only a good thing, but it was essential. Had we not done it, some other country would have done it.
Why do you think that it was a good thing from the point of view of the masses? Do you mean from the point of view of their living standards, or because of religious conflicts, or what?
No, well, not because of religious conflicts, because we could never alter that. I think that'll take many and many a generation yet. There'll always be that difference between the Hindu and the Mohammedan. Although there again, as witnessed at this last reunion that I had only a week ago in London with those ex-cadets, there were both Hindus, Sikhs and Mohammedans present. In other words, they were both from India and Pakistan. But because they had been united under us in the college and in the academy, they could still meet on equal and equal terms and get on well with each other. And I think that, in our small way, I think that's what we did for the country, at any rate militarily, if no other way. We had no effect on the political side, we couldn't. I think we did improve the conditions in the villages, because we had these district commissioners who were British, and they were all ICS men, and they had Indians under them, and those Indians were trained, and they in their turn helped the villagers a lot, I think. That's my impression.
As far as the poverty and low standards of living of the Indian people were concerned, Did you think that these things were Britain's responsibility, or what did you think was the cause of these things?
Well, no, I think you've now got to go back to the rule of the Rajas and the Maharajas. I think there were two factors here. One was that there was extreme richness and extreme poverty on the one hand, and on the other there's the vast population, and the effect of the population was ultimately among the non-ruling classes was nepotism. In other words, if you had a job, you did your utmost to get your brother, your uncle's son, your nephew, and everybody else, Tom, Dick, and Harry, and Uncle Tom, Cobbley, and all, you'd try to get them jobs. And you'd go all out to do that. And it made life very difficult as a result. And on the other hand, as I say, you had the Rajas and the Maharajas who ruled their own roost, rather in a despotic manner, which I think was bad. There were some good Maharajas, of course. But on the other hand, there were some pretty bad ones. And those were the ones who had to have people seconded to them to look after their local provinces, Britishers, and keep these Rajas in order, as it were. Then, of course, after partition, I think, the whole system of keeping the Rajas and Maharajas under the pay of the government was washed out, and the whole idea has slowly just vanished. With, I would think, an improvement in the order of living in the lower classes. I would imagine.